Thanks for that great introduction to the program, Larry. I want all of our listeners to know that there is a PDF lesson outline available for this podcast, and there's always some extra information and sources listed in it which we do not always cover here in the podcast. Most folks have found it very helpful to have it open in front of them as they listen. The PDF is not posted on the Covenant Key website, but I would be glad to send a copy of it to you if you simply email me and request it. My email address is preterist1@preterist.org. Let's ask God for His blessings on our study together. The one and only true God, who created all things and sustains all things by your indomitable and sovereignly powerful word, we give you all praise and glory and honor. Your splendor fills all the infinite heavens. May you reign forever for all generations of the age of the ages. We humble ourselves before you and ask for your guidance upon this nation who has forsaken your ways. Help us to turn back to you and follow your ways again with a whole heart. And be with us now as we study your holy word. Help us understand it better and apply it to our lives in a way that helps us grow spiritually, so that we can teach others your ways and build your kingdom in their hearts. It is for your glory and in the matchless name of your Son Jesus that we pray. Amen. As you can imagine, it takes a lot of time and effort to do the research and produce these historical reconstruction podcasts. We do this as a service to the whole preterist community to help us understand our Bible better and to see how the end-time events were actually fulfilled in the first century at the destruction of Jerusalem. If you have benefited from these studies, and our gracious Lord has blessed you with the desire and the ability to help us financially in this teaching ministry, please send me an email letting us know of your interest in doing that. You can make a one-time donation or contribute monthly, either by PayPal or by credit card. When you contact us here at IPA, we will help you make all of those arrangements. Our email address is preterist1@preterist.org. In our last session, we set dates for the writing of Luke and Acts, as well as for the three prison epistles of Paul, actually three of the five, the first three, which are Ephesians, Colossians, and Philemon. Since the last podcast, I've done a lot more study of those prison epistles and the circumstances under which they were written. My dating and sequencing for those five epistles has had some minor tweaks since we talked about it last time, and I'm going to explain that in this session. We are looking at the events that were happening about the time Paul was released from his first imprisonment in Rome in the winter and spring of AD 62 and 63. Now, we need to keep in mind that Paul was released just a year and a half before the Neronic persecution broke out in the summer of 64, and only 3.5 years before the Jewish war with Rome began in the summer of 66. They were getting close to the end at this time when Paul was just being released from his prison there in Rome. The birth pangs and signs of the times were becoming more frequent and intense. So it was a very, very interesting time, and that's the way the Chinese people talk about putting a curse on somebody. May you live in interesting times. And they certainly were in the first century, especially at this time when Apostle Paul was in prison and James was killed during that same time. John was sent in exile to the island of Patmos just before the Neronic persecution broke out. So there's a lot of things going on here. And another thing that we've noticed that happened about this same time was the death of Barnabas on the island of Cyprus. He was killed by the Jews there, maybe just a little bit before James was killed. We need to keep in mind that there's a lot of things happening right here at this time. This is probably the most busy time of our history up to this point, especially, and maybe even the busiest it'll get before the end in 66 through 70 AD. So for Christians, it's a really, really tough time at this point. Things are really heating up. One thing I need to point out here in our studies of this time period is that we're looking at a lot of historical connections between Apostle Paul, John Mark, and Barnabas. And this is probably just as new and strange to you as it was to me when I first started studying the Epistle of Barnabas. So be patient. The strangeness will eventually be replaced by amazement when you see how intricately involved Barnabas is with Mark and Luke and Paul in their writings. We're going to be looking at a lot more of the historical traditions about Barnabas and Mark in our next two lessons, trying to see how they might connect with biblical facts. The scenario I am constructing here is simply one possible way to put the pieces together. It's certainly not the only way, but it does fit all the New Testament facts together in a way that makes sense and gives lots of new meaning to some of Paul's epistles in ways that you would never have suspected. And it's perfectly okay for you to remain skeptical about these historical reconstructions here that we're making. I'm certainly skeptical. I'm making myself prove them to my own satisfaction. And I'm always on the lookout for a better way of understanding it. So if you spot a defect in my chronology or in the historical narrative that I'm building here, please let me know. Email me and let me know. I'm after truth just like you are. So my email address again is, if you want to contact me about some of this, if you've got questions or comments or a critique of it, my email address is preterist1@preterist.org. And I want to mention another disclaimer here as well. Please don't think that I consider Barnabas to be an inspired apostle on the level of Apostle Paul or Peter. He absolutely was not inspired. And his book was not inspired. And that's why it was not included in our New Testament canon, because it's certainly not an inspired book. And Barnabas was not an inspired apostle either. And so Barnabas was sent out by the church at Antioch to do mission work with Apostle Paul, and was an apostle or missionary of the Antioch church. Of course, the word apostle in the Greek simply means one who is sent out, like an ambassador or a messenger. The Latin equivalent of that is missionary or emissary. The inspired apostles, like Peter and Paul, were sent out by Jesus himself. They were not just sent out by the churches. They were sent out by Christ himself. They were apostles of Christ. Whereas Barnabas was only sent out by the Jerusalem and Antioch churches. Furthermore, that means that anything written by Barnabas was probably not inspired like the writings of our New Testament. It is simply uninspired Christian literature on the same level as a commentary or the Old Testament apocryphal books between the Testaments. They are interesting reading and have some moral and ethical value, but they're not authoritative or inspired. So please don't go away from these studies thinking that I believe the Epistle of Barnabas is inspired scripture, or that Barnabas himself was an inspired and authoritative apostle. He certainly was not, and his epistle was certainly not inspired. When we look at some of the things he wrote in his book, we will see real quickly why I say this. His epistle has numerous statements that are questionable and out of character for inspired writings. There is no doubt whatsoever in my mind that Barnabas was mistaken on a number of points, and we'll see that as we get into his book a little bit more in the next two studies. And we'll also see how Apostle Paul seems to correct some of the mistakes that Barnabas made in Paul's epistles to the Romans and to the Hebrews. And that's probably a new idea for all of us. It certainly was for me. So You'll want to buckle your seatbelt and hang on as we get into our study of these things about Barnabas and his epistle, how that dovetails real nicely into the historical narrative of the book of Acts, as well as what Paul was doing and what he was writing while he was in prison in Rome, awaiting the outcome of his trial. Okay, let's talk a little bit more about Paul's trial and his release in AD 63. In early 63, I believe, the winter of 63, like January, February, maybe March, seems to be the time when Paul was in his trial at Rome. That's when he wrote most of his books, was in the wintertime anyway, so this was the time, I believe, that he wrote most, if not all, of his prison epistles, was during the winter of late 62 and early 63. About January or February, probably, of 63 is when his trial began to happen. Then his release would have occurred sometime about March, maybe, in the spring, early spring, and he was free then to travel, because we notice that he starts to travel with Timothy almost immediately after he's released. So that implies he was in the springtime already by the time of his release. And we want to look at this final phase of his trial in Rome and his release from that imprisonment. We noticed in our comments about the writing of Luke and Acts last time, which occurred sometime in the first year or so of his imprisonment, AD 61 to 62, that these two books, Luke and Acts, appear to have been written for Paul's defense before Nero. Theophilus was evidently some kind of court official or defense attorney for Paul, who needed to know the details of Paul's case. Luke wrote those two books for Theophilus, so that Theophilus would know the exact truth about Christianity and Paul in preparation for defending Paul in court. Evidently, the first year and a half was consumed by the production of Luke and Acts and the book of Hebrews. No other prison epistle seemed to have been written until near the end of his imprisonment when his trial began. So that's what I'm going to be looking at here in this lesson, is we're going to be showing that the 2 years that he was in prison, he was writing, or Luke was writing, Luke and Acts in that first year, and then that was submitted to Theophilus to be used in his trial. And then after that, I believe Paul was working on the book of Hebrews, and he had that pretty much finished by the time his case went to trial in late 62 or early 63. Just before his trial began is when I believe those prison epistles were starting to be written. So we're going to look at that scenario, and I'll provide the evidence from our biblical books. Okay, so the first year and a half of Paul's imprisonment was consumed by the production of Luke and Acts and the book of Hebrews. No other prison epistle seemed to have been written until near the end of his imprisonment when his trial began. It's interesting that the book of Acts contains many court cases which could easily be used as precedents in Paul's trial in order to influence Nero's acquittal of Paul. So the two-volume work of Luke and Acts must have been extremely helpful when Paul's case went to trial before Nero. The fact that Paul was a Roman citizen was also a huge factor in his favor. Furthermore, the evidence from the centurion who guarded Paul during the voyage to Rome would have helped Paul's case immeasurably, as well as the fact that the Jews in Rome never received any letters from Judea criticizing him and condemning him. So that was another big feather in his cap. Also, the whole Praetorian Guard was kindly disposed toward Paul. He says that in the book of Acts, as well as in Philippians chapter 1, verse 13. And according to Philippians 4, verse 22, there were fellow Christians there in Rome who were of Caesar's household. Nero was being surrounded by Christians. It was looking pretty good for Apostle Paul. He had a lot of things going in his favor. Also, another few factors in the outcome of Paul's trial for his benefit, I believe, can be learned from listening or reading the book of Titus, chapter 3, verse 13. Paul mentioned in his letter to Titus, which was written after he was released from prison, that Apollos and Zenas the lawyer had been in Rome with him at the time of his trial. Apollos was a great orator, and Zenas was a lawyer. The implication is that they helped Paul in his defense before Nero. So, Paul had lots of things going for him when his case went to trial before Nero's court. It's therefore no surprise that he was exonerated and released. Now I want to talk a little bit about Paul's epistle to the Philippians. We have noticed in times past, last session, that Ephesians and Colossians were written sometime in 62, very late 62. This time I want to look at Philippians and Philemon, because I think they fit in here as well. And Philippians, I believe, was written just before the end of Paul's trial in Rome. And even though our focus is going to be on the book of Philippians here, we're going to have to look at the other four prison epistles, Ephesians, Colossians, Philemon, and Hebrews, because they were all written about the same time and provide the evidence we need to nail down the date of Philippians. All five of these prison epistles need to be studied in close relation to each other in order to determine not only their dates, but their sequence of writing as well. And that can be determined, by the way, and we'll see that as we look here. Not only the dates, but the sequence. When we do that, we will see that there were three short periods of time near the end of Paul's imprisonment when these five prison epistles were written. And these three periods of time would be, number one, late 62 or early 63, just before or as the trial was beginning. And the second period would be early 63 when the trial was nearly over. And then the third period would be early 63, right after Paul was released from his house arrest. Now, in this session, we're going to show that Ephesians and Colossians were written in that first time period, with Philemon and Philippians in the second time period, and then Hebrews in the third after he was released. Last time we dated the first three prison epistles of Ephesians, Colossians, and Philemon about the middle of his imprisonment in early 62. Now, however, after a lot more analysis, it seems to me that those first three epistles were written late in 62 or extremely early 63, very early 63, not long before the epistle of Philippians and the end of Paul's trial and release. And that'll be more apparent to us as we look more closely at the other two epistles that Paul wrote near the end of his imprisonment, Philippians and Hebrews. The travel of Tychicus, I think, is another key factor in arriving at these dates for these prison epistles. Tychicus, of course, was the courier who carried these first three epistles of Ephesians, Colossians, and Philemon to Asia Minor. And knowing that he was the courier assigned to take those three books to Asia Minor greatly helps us pinpoint the dates for all five of the prison epistles, including Philippians and Hebrews, and I'll show why. Tychicus is mentioned in Ephesians, Colossians, and Philemon as being present with Paul in Rome at the time of writing, but leaving soon to carry these three letters to Asia Minor before the outcome of the trial was known. And since both Philemon and Philippians were written near the end of Paul's trial, when things were looking less uncertain and more promising, it helps us see that Ephesians and Colossians must also have been written not long before Philemon and Philippians. Since Ephesians, Colossians, and Philemon went together with Tychicus, This is double confirmation that they were written shortly before or about the same time as Philippians, which was near the end of the trial when the outcome was expected soon. As we noticed last time in our study of Paul's first three prison epistles, particularly in Philemon, the outcome of the trial was uncertain, but Paul was optimistic in his hope for an acquittal and release, and was already making contingency plans to come visit the Colossians and stay with Philemon if and when he was released. That implies that Philemon was written late in his imprisonment while the trial was underway and while Paul was hoping for a favorable outcome to the trial. In Philippians, however, the outcome of the trial was likewise still uncertain, but Paul expresses more of an expectation, not just a hope, that he would be acquitted and released soon, with the final decision being expected shortly. Here in Philippians, Paul says he is sending Epaphroditus to them with this letter, and that if he is released soon, Paul is released soon, he would come with Timothy to visit them. So that's important information. You know, looking at all this travel information and travel plans is another way to help us nail down the dates for these books, because when we see who was present with Paul at the time of his writing, where those people were going to be going next, who was going to be taking the letters and when, etc. I mean, all those little historical facts and references can be used to date these books and to sequence them. And that's what we're doing, is trying to pull all those facts out and look at them in a continuous stream and see how they fit together. Okay, Epaphroditus, or Epaphras as his nickname would be, is another key figure in all this. Just like Tychicus was the courier for the first three epistles, Epaphras is going to be the courier for the book of Philippians. And studying his evangelistic work and courier movements greatly helps us nail down the dates and sequence of these prison epistles, especially for the book of Philippians, which is the letter he took as a courier to the church in Philippi. Note that Epaphras is mentioned five times in three of Paul's prison epistles, Philippians 2:25, Philippians 4:18, Colossians 1:7, Colossians 4:12, and Philemon 23. He appears to have been taught by Paul, possibly while Paul was at Ephesus on his third missionary trip, and then sent by Paul to establish churches in nearby Colossae, Laodicea, Hierapolis, and the other cities in Asia Minor. This appears to be why Paul lays claim to those churches in the Lycus Valley, since they were established as a result of the work of Epaphras, whom Paul had taught and trained. Epaphras was from Colossae originally, according to Colossians 4, verse 12, and evidently traveled through Philippi on his way to visit Paul in Rome. The Philippians sent some support with Epaphras to give to Paul. He probably visited the church in Philippi on his way to Rome, hoping that they might be able to help him on his way. Apparently they did help him, along with providing for Paul's needs as well. Paul evidently had been in prison in Rome for quite a while before he wrote his letter to the Philippians, and we can deduce that by looking at what Paul says here in Philippians, since he mentions that the Philippians had sent Epaphras to Rome with funds to help Paul. And because those funds were not sufficient to cover all of Paul's needs, Epaphras had worked on the side there in Rome to raise the rest of the needed support. However, he almost worked himself to death and became very sick, Paul says, near unto death. But now he had recovered by the time Paul wrote this epistle, and Paul was sending him back to the Philippians with this letter. Now, all of this stuff that we just discussed here about Epaphras coming with the support and working and getting sick and then recovering, all of that activity presupposes that Paul had been in prison for quite a while by the time he wrote to the Philippians. At the time of writing this epistle to the Philippi church, Paul did not know for sure what the outcome of his trial would be, according to Philippians chapter 1, verse 20 through 25. But he saw the definite need for more mission work and believed that God would somehow allow him to be released in order to do that mission work. We know the trial was underway when he wrote, since he planned to send Timothy to them shortly and immediately as soon as he sees how things go. He could not have had this kind of expectation of release and plans to visit Philippi earlier in his imprisonment when the state of his trial was still very uncertain. This language clearly points to a time late in his imprisonment after the trial had begun when the final decision was expected soon. This would have been near the end of his 2 years of house arrest, since it implies that the outcome would most likely be known very soon. It should be no surprise to us that Philippians chapter 4, verse 21, does not name the brethren who were with Paul in Rome at the time of writing, since his epistle to Philemon had already named them: Timothy, Epaphras, Mark, Aristarchus, Demas, and Luke. So Philemon had already named them, and Philemon was written just right before Philippians, and so the church at Philippi would probably get a copy of that letter to Philemon, so they would know who was there anyway just by reading that letter. But reading Philemon with the list of names there of brethren who was with Paul at the time he wrote Philemon and Philippians helps us date both of those epistles as early in 63, since in both epistles Epaphras was still there in Rome with Paul and had not yet been sent by Paul to carry that letter to the Philippians. Furthermore, both Philemon and Philippians mention Timothy as being there with Paul at the time he wrote, whereas in Hebrews it says that Timothy had been released, just like Paul, but was on a trip somewhere and was expected back from that trip shortly. This indicates that both Philemon and Philippians were written about the same time, while the trial was in progress before the outcome was known, but with Paul being hopeful and expectant about the outcome. When Paul said that he planned to send Timothy shortly, Philippians 2, verses 19 through 24, it sounds very much like the same trip that's referred to in Hebrews 13, verse 23. There are several points of similarity between them. Combining the two accounts, assuming that they are talking about the same trip of Timothy, it means that Paul sent Timothy to Philippi right after the trial was over and waited in Rome for him to return before leaving with Timothy on another trip to visit the churches addressed in the epistle to the Hebrews. Now that's some very, very careful historical reconstruction there, but if you look at Philippians chapter 2, verses 19 to 24, and Hebrews 13, 23, I think you'll see the connection that we're making there. In Philippians, Paul indicates that he was still in prison, but believed he would be released possibly soon, and would come with Timothy to visit the Philippians. We see this idea mentioned in Philemon 22, Philippians 1, 19 through 26, and Philippians 2, verses 23 and 24. Hebrews 13, 23 then mentions that same plan of Paul to come with Timothy to visit the churches addressed in the Hebrews epistle, which evidently included the church in Philippi. So evidently Philippi was one of those churches that Paul addressed in the Hebrews epistle. Now, you'll notice I'm assigning the authorship of the epistle to the Hebrews to Apostle Paul. That may be a little bit surprising to some people, but it shouldn't be surprising when we look at what chapter 13 of Hebrews has to say. I mean, it's clear that whoever wrote this, they were a close traveling companion of Apostle Paul and had just been released from prison, same as Timothy, and that as soon as Timothy returned, that person writing the book of Hebrews was going to go with Timothy to visit those churches that are addressed in the book of Hebrews. So, I mean, that only fits one person. That does not fit anybody else. It doesn't fit Barnabas. It doesn't fit Peter. It doesn't fit Apollos. It doesn't fit anybody except the Apostle Paul. And so we don't need to be real careful in our study here to see real easily that Apostle Paul must have written the book of Hebrews. As we can see in these studies, Philippians and Hebrews, and comparisons of the similarities between their historical narratives, we can see that Hebrews was definitely written by Apostle Paul. It's pretty clear. And not only do these studies show that Paul wrote the book of Hebrews, but it also helps us fix the date of the rest of those prison epistles as well, Philemon, Philippians, and Hebrews, those last three out of the five that were written right near the end of Paul's trial and release from Roman imprisonment. And if Philemon was written near the end of his trial, then Ephesians and Colossians could not have been written a lot earlier, because all three epistles were delivered at the same time by the same courier to the same churches in Asia Minor. And so, since they were going on the same trip, they probably were not written too far apart. So that's why I'm redating Ephesians and Colossians to a little closer to the actual trial, rather than way back in the middle of his imprisonment, like I did before in the previous session. So that's the adjustment that we're making to the date of Ephesians and Colossians. In Hebrews, Epaphroditus is not mentioned at all, as he was in the previous two epistles, Philippians and Philemon. In Hebrews, he's not mentioned at all, implying that the letter to the Philippians had already been sent out by Epaphroditus by the time Hebrews was written. Now, that's a little historical deduction there that you can read between the lines, not only what he says, but what he doesn't say about who was there with him at the time he wrote. Also in Hebrews, Paul has already been acquitted and released, and was about to come with Timothy, who was also released, to visit the churches that were addressed in the book of Hebrews, just as he said he would earlier in the book of Philippians. According to Philippians 1:19-26, it appears that one of the stops that Paul and Timothy would make along their way to Colossae would be the church in Philippi. Furthermore, neither epistle, Philippians or Hebrews, mentions any other co-workers by name as being with Paul in Rome other than Timothy and Epaphroditus. And as we noticed, Epaphroditus is not mentioned in Hebrews, only in Philippians. However, Philippians does mention the brethren who are with me and some other saints, especially those of Caesar's household. This also indicates a date of writing for Philippians late in Paul's imprisonment, after his evangelistic efforts there had produced much fruit, even among the Praetorian Guard and in Caesar's household. So that's another good reason from inside the book to date Philippians late in his imprisonment. Even though the greetings at the end of Philippians and Hebrews are not the same, the greeting at the end of Philippians is identical word for word with the greeting in Philemon, suggesting that Philemon and Philippians were written about the same time. So the sequence of writing for these last three prison epistles appears to be Philemon first, Philippians next, and then Hebrews after Paul was released. These comparisons between Philemon, Philippians, and Hebrews indicate that Philemon and Philippians were written just before the end of Paul's imprisonment, when the outcome of the trial was still uncertain, but very optimistic. Whereas Hebrews, of course, was written after the trial was over and Paul had been released. So here's how we would date and sequence these five prison epistles in relation to those three periods of time that we mentioned at the beginning of our study. Ephesians and Colossians were first. They were written in late 62 or early 63, just before or as the trial was beginning. And then Philemon and Philippians were next, written in early 63 when the trial was already in progress and just about over. And then, of course, Hebrews was written after Paul was released in early 63. Right after Philemon was written, Tychicus left with all three epistles, Ephesians, Colossians, and Philemon, to deliver them to the churches in Asia Minor. Philippians was not written long after Philemon. It was written before the trial was over, and then was sent to Philippi using Epaphroditus as the courier. So we got two different couriers here, Tychicus carrying three letters to Asia Minor, and Epaphroditus carrying one letter to Philippi. Now I want to deal with the epistle to the Hebrews a little bit more. You'll note that I start out with the assumption that it was written by Apostle Paul. We'll see why that's so important to understand as we go further down into the book of Hebrews in our study here. I'm not going to spend a lot of time arguing for his authorship, since that has been thoroughly argued and bantered back and forth in all the various commentaries on Hebrews. However, I did put some material together on that, and I put it in the PDF. And so if you get the PDF for this podcast, you'll have that information that I put together on the authorship of Paul for the Epistle of Hebrews. Simply email me and request the PDF on the authorship of Hebrews, and I'll send it to you. My email address again is preterist1@preterist.org. Now let's talk a little bit more about the book of Hebrews itself. Here at the beginning of our discussion on Hebrews, I want to point out something which should be obvious, which many of us have overlooked, including myself. I didn't really think about it too much until I started studying the book of Hebrews, and that is this. We know that the epistle of Hebrews was sent to the churches right after Paul was released from prison in early 63. Now, the key word there is sent. The epistle was sent to the churches right after he was released. However, that does not automatically mean that it was written in that short space of time between his release and his leaving Rome with Timothy soon afterwards, Hebrews 13, verse 23. That should be an obvious fact, that it could not have been written in that short space after he was released. The book is too sophisticated in its argumentation and exhortation to have been hastily thrown together at the last minute after Paul was released. The complexity and sublimity of his theology demands an extended period of time for its composition. That's why I'm suggesting that it was most likely written during the last year of Paul's imprisonment, after Luke had finished his two-volume work on Luke and Acts, but before the other four prison epistles were written, and was evidently pretty much finished by the time Paul's case went to trial, because that's when he starts writing these other four prison epistles. So I would fit the book of Hebrews in that period of time between Luke and Acts and those other four prison epistles. That's when it was written and pretty much finished, by the time Paul's case went to trial. Then, after the trial was over and he was released, he added the closing verses of chapter 13 and sent it on its way by courier. Now, if this is a correct reconstruction of the scenario, then it means that Hebrews was actually written before the other four prison epistles, during the year of 62, but not sent by courier until after the trial was over in early 63. That's a subtle point, I'm sure, but it needs to be hammered here a little bit, because it's not safe for us to assume that the book was written after he was released from prison. It was written before he was released, and then sent after he was released. Further evidence that this is the correct dating for Hebrews comes from its similarities and connections with the book of Revelation. It is not without significance that the similarities between Hebrews and the book of Revelation do not show up in Hebrews until late in the book, chapters 12 and 13. This gives us a clue as to when the book of Revelation was written in relationship to the book of Hebrews, and vice versa. The book of Hebrews was probably started to be written by Paul before he received a copy of the book of Revelation. Then later in 62, after Paul received that copy of the Revelation, he included some material in chapters 12 and 13 of the book of Hebrews, which show his awareness of the book of Revelation. Paul would have received his copy late in the writing process of the book of Hebrews, sometime late in 62 AD, after John had written the book of Revelation on the island of Patmos in mid to late 62. It would have had time easily to get to Paul in Rome, which was not that far away from Patmos, less than a month of traveling distance, and in fact, probably a few weeks. So it's not hard to explain how the book of Revelation could end up in Rome in Paul's hands and be included in the book of Hebrews. That explains, I believe, why the similarities with the book of Revelation that we find in the book of Hebrews do not show up in Hebrews until chapters 12 and 13, because he had evidently already written the first 11 chapters of Hebrews before the book of Revelation arrived. And so he used material from the book of Revelation to write chapters 12 and 13. Paul added the final verses to Hebrews, which is the closing historical data in chapters 13, verses 22 through 25, just after his release and before he left Italy to travel with Timothy toward Colossae in the spring of AD 63. The epistle was evidently sent by courier to Paul's network of churches in Greece, Macedonia, and Turkey while he was waiting for Timothy to return. He sent that courier out with the book of Hebrews. And then when Timothy returned, he and Timothy went to visit those churches that had been addressed in the book of Hebrews, including, of course, the church in Philippi. And we're going to talk more about who that courier was for the book of Hebrews. I think you're going to be very interested in finding out who that was. It's not who you would expect. There's going to be some very interesting historical connections there when we discover who that courier was for the book of Hebrews. So Paul sends it on its way by courier while he waits for Timothy to get back from his trip so that they can go visit the churches. And I'm going to give you a little hint here about who the courier for the book of Hebrews might have been. When we look at the traditions about Barnabas and Mark and how it relates to Paul and his epistles, I think we're going to discover who that courier really was. I think it's probably Mark, and we'll look at that and see the evidence for it next time. That's going to wrap up our session this time. Next time I want to get back into the historical traditions about Barnabas and Mark so that we can connect more of the dots between Paul and Barnabas and Mark. I think you're going to be amazed at what we discover about all these connections between these three guys. You'll never read the book of Hebrews the same way again. It's going to make an awful lot of sense for you. Well, that'll do it for this time. If any of this material has raised questions for you, if you would like to point out any defects in my reasoning or in my chronology here, or if you need any more information about some of this, don't hesitate to email me. My email address is preterist1@preterist.org. And I want to also remind you that there's a lot of great supplementary articles posted on our website, plus books and audio and video media for purchase there, and I would encourage you to go there and browse and pick up some of that stuff. Make a great gift for you. The link for that is www.preterist.org. Well, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.